This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of Global Finance Advisory are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Good morning, everybody. Richard Martin here from the Wake Up Call, coming to you recorded today. I am not speaking live, so please don't call in with your comments and questions. But nevertheless, I am with you for the hour, and we are going to start by talking about gold today. Give you some idea of what's going on in the gold market behind the scenes. There is a corner of Switzerland where Italian is spoken, and roughly one-third of the world's gold is refined into bars and ingots, where business is booming. Every day, bangles, bracelets, and necklaces arrive in plastic bags from souks in the Middle East, from pawn shops in Asia, and from corner jewelers in Europe and North America. And I'm quoting for Erhard Oberle, the chief executive of Argor Heraeus, a major refiner that processes roughly 400 tons of gold a year, who says, "It could be your grandmother's gold or the gift of an ex-boyfriend. Gold doesn't disappear." Well, amid a global frenzy fed by multi-billion dollar hedge funds, wealthy speculators and governments all rushing to stock up on the precious yellow metal, the price of gold briefly surpassed $1,200 an ounce 2 weeks ago, a record high. Well, as I'm sure you know, it's long considered the ultimate refuge for nervous investors, and gold has in fact climbed as the dollar has steadily weakened and the budget deficits have expanded in the United States and Europe, and central banks have continued to pump trillions of dollars into weak economies, creating fears of another asset bubble that will ultimately pop. Suki Cooper, a precious metal strategist for Barclays Capital, and I quote, "It's not that gold has changed, but gold buyers have changed. It's a structural shift we're seeing on the investing side, from Asian central banks right down to individual investors buying ingots and coins." Well, last month, Harrods, the 160-year-old London department store, began selling coins as well as gold bullion, ranging from tiny 1-gram ingots to the hefty 12.5-kilogram 400-troy-ounce bricks that are so often featured in movies and stocked inside the vaults of Fort Knox. Harrods' lower ground floor, where the gold is peddled, has been packed with interested shoppers. "The response has been astounding," said Chris Hall, head of Harrods Gold Bullion. "Bars are definitely more popular than coins. The 100 gram is the most popular." Well, in the United States, ads promising high prices for gold are regular fodder for late-night television spots, while buyers are setting up tables at shopping malls or hosting gold-buying gatherings at private homes like recession-era Tupperware parties. "Everyone and their grandmother has a sign out saying, 'We buy gold,'" said Rod Lieberman, the owner of Palisade Jewelers in Englewood, New Jersey. He estimates that 10 times as many people come into his store to sell gold now as when the metal was selling for $300 an ounce at the beginning of the decade. "I hear people come in and say gold is going to $2,000, he said. Jewelry store shoppers aren't the only ones forecasting lofty prices. Jim Rogers, an investor who has made his name investing overseas and in commodities, predicted to Bloomberg Television a couple of weeks ago that gold might reach $2,000 an ounce, prompting a rebuke from Nouriel Roubini, whom you all know, I quote frequently here, an economist who gained attention for his early warnings about the global economic crisis. And at a conference in New York on Wednesday, Roubini described Rogers' forecast as utter nonsense, saying that there aren't any inflationary or economic pressures that would drive the price of gold to $2,000 an ounce. Even the most bullish of gold lovers were surprised a few weeks ago when the Reserve Bank of India stepped in and bought 220 tons of gold from the International Monetary Fund for $6.7 billion. A sign that other central banks might move away from dollar-denominated assets like treasury bonds in favor of the precious metal. India's huge purchase means that gold will now account for about 6% of India's $285.5 billion of foreign exchange reserves, up from the previous level of about 4%. "We have money to buy gold," said Pranab Mukherjee, India's finance minister. "We have enough foreign exchange reserves." Recently, Sri Lanka's central bank disclosed that it too was buying gold in a trend that could hurt the United States over time because it needs foreign bond buyers, especially central banks, to finance its growing debt. China has already doubled its gold reserves over the last 6 years, but the Indian move underscored how even the most traditional investors are shifting a portion of their assets into bullion. "I have never been a gold bug," Paul Tudor Jones, the prominent hedge fund manager, told his investors last month. "It is just an asset that, like everything else in life, has its time and place. And now is that time." Overall, in the second quarter of 2009, consumption of gold for jewelry plunged 20%, while investor demand for gold increased 51%, according to the World Gold Council. Demand for bars weighing 100 ounces or less for individual investors is up 80%, according to Marwan Shakarchi, the chairman of MKS Finance, a Geneva company. Inflows of old gold jewelry and individual investor sales are especially strong in the United States and Western Europe, which is a new phenomenon for MKS, according to Mr. Shakarchi. In the past, hoarding gold as an investment was much more popular in the Middle East and Asia. And I quote, "Europe and the United States are our emerging markets." In addition to high anxiety about the future, recent political trends may also be playing a part in the global gold fever. With a crackdown on tax havens worldwide and Swiss bankers handing over the names of wealthy American clients to authorities, some experts say rich people now prefer an investment that can easily be hidden from the prying eyes of tax collectors. According to Bernhard Schnellmann, director for precious metal services at Argo Heraeus, in Europe, people want physical gold to store themselves with no documents. Often the company doesn't know the ultimate destination of the bars it makes, only the identity of the bank in Zurich or London that is handling the order. One 100-gram bar, popular in Switzerland, just about fits in the palm of your hand and has a $3,500 price tag. The standard 12.5-kilo, 400-ounce brick, on the other hand, is a monster, straining the wrist as well as the imagination. Just one of these thick bars commands a higher price than a studio apartment in Manhattan. Well, at the airport in Zurich, where there are special vaults to hold gold, shipments of jewelry arrive daily on early morning flights before making their way via a twisty 3-hour journey through the mountains on tightly guarded trucks. After the jewelry is unloaded, gold ingots, bars, and other forms of bullion already stacked like cordwood along the sooty corridors of Argo Heraeus are sent back to Zurich in the same trucks. And according to Mr. Oberle, the truck never drives back empty. Time is so important because the value of the material is so high. Oberle is also confident that he is running a business that, even in the middle of one of the worst economic downturns of the last century, is relatively recession-proof and always of interest to investors. "Gold has been around as an investment for 6,000 years," he said. "When there is no alternative, it's there." Well, ladies and gentlemen, what do you do with information like that? I mean, what can you possibly make of it? And anybody who gets the right answer probably gets a gold star at this point, because most people would be sucked in by what I just told you. They would think, how quickly can I possibly get down to the nearest pawn shop and buy myself some gold? But you know, the reality is that when everybody and his dog and his next door neighbor's mother's pet budgerigar are buying gold, then you know that the game is up, at least, at the very least, temporarily. And in the in the futures markets, gold is trading with the largest amount of speculators long in gold in the history of trading of gold. That, unfortunately, is the kiss of death for any market. If you consider that gold goes in the opposite direction to the dollar, and you consider that there are less than 3% of operators in the dollar bullish on the dollar itself, then you have to assume that the game is up in gold, at least, as I say, on a short-term basis, at least. And who knows, you know, where else we may be projecting in the future. But right now, as I said to you before, if you are of a mind to buy gold, my advice to you is don't. The price of gold today, Thursday, we are now actually, as I record this show, it's Thursday the 17th, it's about 10 o'clock in the morning, and the price of gold is down $20 an ounce. So, as I say, word to the wise, be careful when everybody is telling you to do something. Chances are you're best off doing the opposite. But anyway, this is Richard Martin. It's the wake-up call. As I told you, this is a recorded show, so please do not call the toll-free number, because there will be nobody there to answer your call. You can, however, email me, as always, with your questions, and please feel very free to do so at any time. The email address is rm@gfawd.com. And I'll repeat that. The RM, of course, stands for Richard Martin. GFAWD stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. And once again, I give you the email address, rm@gfawd.com. And although I am in halfway around the world in Singapore, you are still able to contact me on a local United States phone number, and the call will come through to me. And the number to call is area code 941-441-1682. Once more, I repeat the number to call if you would like to discuss your personal investments or financial concerns of one sort or another. You're welcome to call me on 941-441-1682. All right. Well, just a quick word about our program on Sunday, which is entitled the Richard Martin Discussion Group. We had a very good discussion last week on immigration and the whys and wherefores and the benefits, and it was really a delight, and people called in and we had a nice discussion. The subject under discussion this coming Sunday will be the economy. Nothing very original there, but I'm anxious and interested to hear of your personal anecdotes in terms of how the current depression is playing out for you. This is a very important conversation that we shall have on Sunday. I hope as many of you as possible will listen to it, because I think you will gain a lot, hopefully, if people call in and give their opinions on these things. It should be very interesting and, in many cases, maybe a heartbreaking discussion, but certainly I think it will be worth your while to listen to what your fellow listeners are experiencing during this horrendous occasion, which is being described by the government as the end of the recession. Everything is getting much, much better, and banks are paying back their TARP money, and the party will play on. Well, nothing could be further from the truth, ladies and gentlemen. This is just a cruel joke being foisted upon you in the hope that you will go out and spend even more money and, you know, feed the fat cats. I mean, it's a crime of the first order to fool people into thinking, and basically even, you know, to shame people into thinking that they're the ones, the losers, you know, everybody else is doing what they have to do, but, you know, those that are not participating are kind of sore losers. Well, ladies and gentlemen, just keep listening to the show and you'll find you're in very, very good company if you have a problem. As I say, if you can listen in on Sunday and call in, if you do call in, hold the line, you know, to make your comment, make your point, and then don't hang up, because quite often somebody else will have something to say, and then I will call upon you to follow up with another comment. And our engineer is always very attentive to who's on the line. He's telling me at any given moment who is still around after their comment. And so if I feel that I can bring you back in to talk, then we will just try to sort of mastermind a conversation. And I will do that from a distance of 17,500 miles. So am I further from the moon here than I am from New York City? I'm not quite sure, but anyway, it can be done, ladies and gentlemen. I will do it, courtesy of 21st century technology, and a good time shall be had by all. Well, can you imagine an America without a strong middle class? If you can, would it still be America as we know it? Today, one in five Americans is unemployed, underemployed, or just plain out of work. One in nine families can't make the minimum payment on their credit cards. One in eight mortgages is in default or foreclosure. One in eight Americans is on food stamps, which, by the way, is generally considered to today to be the equivalent of the 1930s soup kitchens. More than 120,000 families are filing for bankruptcy every month. The economic crisis has wiped more than $5 trillion from pensions and savings, has left family balance sheets upside down, and threatens to put 10 million homeowners out on the street. Families have survived the ups and downs of economic booms and busts for a long time, but the fall behind during the busts has got worse, while the surge ahead during the booms has stalled out. In the boom of the 1960s, for example, median family income jumped by 33%, adjusted for inflation. But the boom of the 2000s resulted in an almost imperceptible 1.6% increase for the typical family. While Wall Street executives and others who owned lots of stock celebrated how good the recovery was for them, middle-class families were left empty-handed. The crisis facing the middle class started more than a generation ago. Even as productivity rose, the wages of the average fully employed male have been flat since the 1970s. But core expenses kept going up. By the early 2000s, families were spending twice as much, adjusted for inflation, on mortgages than they did a generation ago, for a house that was, on average, only 10% bigger and 25 years older. They also had to pay twice as much to hang on to their health insurance. To cope, millions of families put a second parent into the workforce. But higher housing and medical costs, combined with new expenses for childcare, the costs of a second car to get to work, and higher taxes, combined to squeeze families even harder. Even with two incomes, they tightened their belts. Families today spend less than they did a generation ago on food, clothing, furniture, appliances, and other flexible purchases. But it hasn't been enough to save them. Today's families have spent all their income, have spent all their savings, and have gone into debt to pay for college, to cover serious medical problems, and just to stay afloat a little while longer. Through it all, families never asked for a handout from anyone, especially Washington. They were left to go on their own, working harder, squeezing nickels, and taking care of themselves. But their economic boats have been taking on water for years, and now the crisis has swamped millions of middle-class families. The contrast with the big banks could not be sharper. While the middle class has been caught in an economic vice, the financial industry that was supposed to serve them has prospered at their expense. Consumer banking, selling debt to middle-class families, has been a gold mine. Boring banking has given way to creative banking. Then the industry has generated tens of billions of dollars annually in fees made possible by deceptive and dangerous terms buried in the fine print of opaque, incomprehensible, and largely unregulated contracts. And when various forms of this creative banking triggered economic crises, the banks went to Washington for a handout. All the while, top executives kept their jobs and retained their bonuses. Even though the tax dollars that supported the bailout came largely from middle-class families, from people already working hard to make ends meet, the beneficiaries of those tax dollars are now lobbying Congress to preserve the rules that had let those huge banks feast off the middle class. Pundits talk about populist rage as a way to trivialize the anger and fear coursing through the middle class. But they have it wrong. Families understand with crystalline clarity that the rules they have played by are not the same rules that govern Wall Street. They understand that no American family is too big to fail. They recognize that business models have shifted and that big banks are pulling out all the stops to squeeze families and boost revenues. They understand that their economic security is under assault, and that leaving consumer debt effectively unregulated does not work. Families are ready for change. According to polls, large majorities of Americans have welcomed the Obama administration's proposal for a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency, known as CFPA. The CFPA would be answerable to consumers, not to banks and not to Wall Street. The agency would have the power to end tricks and traps pricing and to start leveling the playing field so that consumers have the tools they need to compare prices and manage their money. The response of the big banks has been to swing into action against the agency, fighting with all their lobbying might to keep business as usual. They are pulling out all the stops to kill the agency before it is born. And if those practices crush millions more families, who cares? So long as the profits stay high and the bonuses keep coming. America today has plenty of rich and super rich, but it has far more families who did all the right things, but who still have no real security. Going to college and finding a good job no longer guarantee economic safety. Paying for a child's education and setting aside enough for a decent retirement have become distant dreams. Tens of millions of once secure middle-class families now live paycheck to paycheck, watching as their debts pile up and worrying about whether a pink slip or a bad diagnosis will send them hurtling over an economic cliff. America without a strong middle class, unthinkable, but the once solid foundation is crumbling. Well, speaks for itself, doesn't it, ladies and gentlemen? Let me talk a little bit about why housing prices are too high and why there is no alternative to forcing prices down to levels at which ordinary people can afford to pay the asking rents and why those rents will have to fall precipitously. It's something I haven't really covered, but I think it deserves a mention, and I think you should all be aware of the rationale involved. You know, housing costs are still much too high. So what is the irresponsible solution favored by the government? Borrow $1.2 trillion to buy toxic dead zone mortgages so irresponsible lenders can pump out another couple of trillion in soon-to-be toxic mortgages. The solution is to lower the cost structure at the fundamental level. You want to encourage small businesses? Then let every commercial real estate owner in the nation go bankrupt and sell all the millions of square feet of commercial space for 10 cents on the dollar. The new owner's cost basis will be so low that they can rent out a space for $500 a month that once required $5,000 a month just to cover the bloated mortgage on a grossly overvalued property. The Fed is trying to hold back the tide with very expensive sandcastles. Now that the federal government owns the insolvent Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgage giants, It has shifted the speculative lending to FHA, or the Federal Housing Administration, which as a result is now in financial trouble and needs a bailout to remain semi-solvent. Surprise, surprise. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the result of hyping home ownership as a speculative investment during bubbles. Equity plummets as prices revert to historic averages. As a percentage of GDP, homeowner equity has already dropped below the 1997 pre-bubble line. As far as actual equity is concerned, as opposed to nominal prices, the housing bubble's gains have already been completely erased. It stands to common sense that negative equity drives foreclosures. At some point, the burdens of attempting to pay a mortgage which far exceeds the value of the property makes little financial sense. Given that 15 million plus households have negative equity, we can see that the foreclosure short sale pipeline is stuffed for years to come. I repeat, years to come. California prices have already retraced about three-quarters of the bubble. Another 35%, or roughly $100,000, would complete the reversion to pre-bubble valuations. It is important to note that the housing bubble had little to do with the actual construction or material costs. The bubble was entirely debt financial based. As this classic situation unfolds, construction costs actually dropped from the 1980s, which were the peaks of their time. And as for demographics and the population driving prices higher, if that's true, then why are there 18 million vacant dwellings in the United States? And that's according to the Census Bureau. It's nonsense. They're giving you a line, ladies and gentlemen. They are trying to tell you that the bottom is at hand and it's time to buy real estate. Do not fall for it. It is self-serving. It is entirely in the service of the financial institution that benefits when you or I go out and buy a house. So here we have these high rents and the cause of them is high mortgage costs, which are caused by high valuations. You know, Joe Blow buys a rental building in the bubble years and his mortgage is huge. So he has to raise rents in order to make his monthly nut. Is the high rent related to anything other than a speculative frenzy? Of course not. So if Mr. Blow's building goes into foreclosure and is auctioned off at 50% of what he paid, then the new owner can cover the revalued mortgage for considerably less money. So resetting housing valuations for owners also resets housing costs for renters. From at least one point of view, the entire project of persuading Americans that home ownership was the high road to accumulating wealth was a stupendous scam perpetrated by those industries which benefited from the elevation of home ownership to quasi-religious status. Yes, it creates stable communities. But when households essentially enter debt servitude to support owning a house, driving up rents in the bargain, is either the household or community served in the long run? The government's doomed obsession with propping up high house prices have left one class of homeowners in the shadows, the one-third of homeowners who own their homes free and clear. Those without a mortgage resisted the temptation to extract all their equity. They have no mortgage. Price fluctuations don't mean much to them. The same can be said of those whose mortgage was based on pre-bubble valuations. Yes, it was glorious to be worth a small fortune at the top, but life goes on. The mortgage is still affordable and the owners still retain substantial equity even after prices have fallen. For those who are underwater, short selling, which is selling a house worth less than the mortgage and the bank accepts the loss, or in a foreclosure, isn't a reversion to much lower values in their interests too? Once they rebuild their finances and credit, in a few years they might be able to buy a house for a price which is actually affordable by historic standards, i.e. about 25% of net income going to the mortgage. As I already mentioned, lower valuations help the nation's renters too, lowering the cost basis of the property owners and making renting and buying more competitive, a boon to both markets. The only real solution to unaffordable high cost structures is to dramatically lower the cost basis of the entire sector, nor industry or market. Housing prices dropping another 35% and removing the speculative mindset from housing will, in the long run, greatly benefit householders and the nation. So, ladies and gentlemen, each time you hear about prices falling, welcome that, because it's going to be in your interests over time, and you will be the beneficiaries. And if you're not the beneficiaries because you already have houses which are fully paid off, I can assure you that your children and your children's children will be grateful. And again, it's all called deflation. That's the name of the game. It's deflation with a capital D. And of course, for the majority of those involved in the process, those in the financial service industry who have aided and abetted this appalling speculative frenzy, they are horrified at the prospect of deflation, and they're calling upon their friends in government to do everything in their power to prevent it, which they are trying to do with no success. And neither will they have any success. You cannot expect that people without money can push prices higher. The government can do all it wants to try to force prices higher, but time and time again, history shows us that they do not succeed. Mr. Bernanke, would you please wake up? You know, Times Man of the Year, my foot. Well, the latest that we have from the hot off the press is that the recession is weighing on Americans' waistlines. The obesity rate has increased, according to a new study. The economic downturn is busting wallets and bursting waistlines as consumers shift their eating habits to help their budgets. With unemployment in the double digits, consumers who find themselves increasingly strapped have turned to cheaper means to feed their families. And those who have jobs are working longer hours, foregoing exercise, and searching for food that's economical and convenient. As a result, more consumers are turning to processed foods, either prepared, frozen, or canned, and often filled with fat-generating calories, refined grains, and sugar. Experts are saying that's making more Americans chubbier and prone to obesity-related illnesses such as diabetes in what has been dubbed recession fat. Eating healthy has been one of the big casualties of this economic downturn, according to Harry Balzer, chief industry analyst at the NPD Group and author of the research company's annual Eating Patterns in America report. And I quote, "Last year, consumers cut back on eating for better for you and organic foods. The culprit is cost. About 70% of respondents to a recent Technomatic Inc. survey said healthier foods are increasingly difficult to afford." And you may have heard that coupons are being used at a faster clip. The savings vehicles are on track to post their first increase since 1992. Most experts expect retail sales this holiday will be no better than 2008, which ranked as the worst season in four decades. Searches on Google for printable coupons and online printable coupons have more than doubled this year. Of consumers surveyed by the National Retail Federation, 42% said they plan to use a coupon for their holiday shopping. At coupons.com, one of the first and largest online coupon sites, consumers printed coupons worth $313 million in 2008. The site surpassed that full year figure in June 2009 and expects $1 billion in printed coupon savings by year's end. Well, according to Detroit News, and I quote, "It's going to be a merry but frugal Christmas. Shoppers are buying less, making more gifts, and being thoughtful about it being looking like a lot like a frugal Christmas. Many shoppers are bypassing fancy electronic gizmos, fine jewelry, and cashmere sweaters, and making their own gifts this year, according to experts. Revelers are giving more thoughtful gifts, having get-togethers at home and leaving the bling out of festivities. And I quote Mike Bernacki, who's a marketing expert at the University of Detroit Mercy, who says, and I quote, "People are buying gifts for fewer people. They're being more selective with gifts. Parties will be downsized. Decorations won't be as elaborate. And homemade gifts will be big. This is the first holiday season with the new consumer," end of quote. Well, apparently shoppers are expected to spend an average of $507.90 on holiday gifts, food, and decorations this year, compared to $534.79 last year, and that's according to the National Retail Federation. This comes a year after retailers recorded the steepest drop in holiday spending in 40 years. Holiday sales will decline by another $4 billion this year. Well, enter Tim Geithner with more smoke. The other day he gave out the news that the TARP program earned a profit for the federal government. Let's see, how does that work? Oh yeah, you lend banks money below the real cost so they can borrow for practically nothing. Then they lend the money back to you for a cool 300 basis point spread. Then you buy from them the speculative investments they made that didn't pay off. They keep the ones that go up, and you pump money into the counterparties so they don't take the losses they richly deserve, and then you invest in them through the TARP program, and when their stocks go up, well, you've made a profit. Oh, thanks, Tim Geithner. Let's have a little bit more of the same, I don't think. Okay, well, I wanted to respond to a caller, or actually maybe it was an email, I can't remember. Someone anyway who asked the other day about Canadian real estate, and I had to say I didn't follow that market. Well, I have important news for you today from Carl Denninger, the famous and very successful commentator and blogger. And I quote, "In point of fact, doing a bit of research after the show, I came up with the following. Canadian family income as a whole, families of two persons or more, is allegedly $70,000 a year, approximately. The average house price, $325,000, which is a multiple of 4.64, or dramatically into bubble territory. The maximum for affordable housing is roughly three times, so this is 154% of the maximum. It's worse in places like Vancouver. There, the ratio is over 10 for single-family homes and about 8 for all residences. Let me be clear, strictly on the numbers. Canada is in for a housing bust worse than the United States. Beware, Canadians. You can argue over the timing of the outcome, but if you think the bad event won't happen and act on that belief, don't cry when a year or three down the road I start piping up with, 'I told you so.' Well, thank you, Carl Denninger, for that piece of useful information, and I hope the listener or caller was listening, because I think that is valuable information. I wish I had had it at the time of the call. I'm clearly sorry I didn't, and I don't follow Canadian affairs very closely, so I do depend on the outside contributions from people who know a lot better than I. All right, well, now we come to Steve Kruger's contribution for the day, sent just a few days ago, and this is what he has to say. Richard, after hearing you and Gary talking about the hard times ahead in 2006, we spent the 2006 winter considering selling our house of 37 years. We had a good realtor, priced it right, and sold it the first day. That's the 10th of July, 2007. Lucky. We were looking to rent in South Jersey. Our criteria was it had to be a decent size and it had to be safe. We never gave moving out of the country a thought. At our age, it just wasn't a consideration. Old dogs, new tricks. Sometimes they learn them, most often they don't. On our first trip apartment hunting, we stopped for a local newspaper in Smithville, New Jersey. There was only one apartment for rent, and it was in Brigantine, New Jersey. We called, and 20 minutes later, we met with the owner. The house is a two-family house, and the owner is a real estate agent who was into flipping houses. The apartment was hers, and she was moving into a house to fix up and flip. Richard, the apartment was amazing. 1,650 square feet, two-bedroom, two-bath, laundry room, a 30-foot living room, and a deck that you can see the ocean from. All this was $1,450 a month. We almost knocked her over giving her a check. Some might worry about being so close to the ocean, but I am of the opinion that for my entire life, my government has lied to me about everything. So when my government tells me the ice caps are melting and I should move 50 miles inland, I move 1,000 feet from the ocean and we feel perfectly safe. According to Al Gore, I should be up to my neck in water, yet my ankles are not even wet. Getting back to safety, the best security you can have is put a moat around your house. Living on an island, you in effect have a moat around your house. You can equate it to living in a castle in the Middle Ages. In dangerous times, all in the castle have a common goal. It is to stay safe, sort of a single community mind. A little about the town. Brigantine, founded in 1897. 6.5 square miles in area, elevation is 6 feet above sea level, population 12,000. The crime rate, national average, is 320.9. Brigantine's rate is 88.7, so it's one-third the average. The police force is 50 full-time and around 10 extra during the summer. Burglaries average 50 per year. Since 1999, there was one murder and 7 rapes. The way on and off the island is a bridge, 2 lanes in, 2 lanes out. In the event of civil unrest, the police could block the bridge. We have come to find out that our landlord is being foreclosed on her flip house and will be moving into the smaller downstairs apartment. Over the years, they've made good money flipping houses. Well, Richard, in 2007, after we signed the lease, I told my wife this is not the time to flip a house and that the landlord could hit a wall with that house. To make things for them, her husband, a carpenter, can't find work. Thanks for the wake-up call, Steve Kruger. Well, excellent, very, very nice anecdotal information, Steve. And I just wish that one of these days the phone will go, my engineer will come online, and he will say, Steve Kruger, online with a question. That will be the day, Steve. I'm still waiting to hear it, and I am confident that I shall. Well, Loretta Lynn, remember her? Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. Well, Loretta was singing about kicking the bucket. Well, kicking the can seems to be what most people do before they kick the bucket. It's also what Congress does before Treasury bills kick the bucket. You know, it's become clear to millions of voters around the world that their national governments have not offered statistically viable solutions to the looming budget deficits. These deficits threaten to consume more than the future revenues available to the various national governments to fulfill their long-term promises and welfare programs for old people. Central bankers can call a halt to this at any time by ceasing to purchase assets. This would stabilize the monetary base, at least until banks started failing, thereby contracting M1. This would continue to produce a depression. Politicians say they want solutions to the budget deficit problem, but the political price is the replacement of incumbents by newly elected politicians who campaigned on a call for an end to the depression. Everybody wants to go to heaven. Stable money, rising employment, and government growth. But nobody wants to walk through the valley of the shadow of death, otherwise known as Great Depression II. So Congress refuses to face squarely the projected cost of these promises. Economists tell us that there is still time to fund these programs if we begin now. They have told us this every year since the early 1970s. All that needs to be done is for Congress to fund these future expenditures. But Congress does nothing. On the contrary, it increases the amount of unfunded liabilities. which are now, by the way, in the range of $80 trillion. Did you hear that, ladies and gentlemen? $80 trillion. Rather than dealing with what are statistically inescapable deficits in an already massive federal budget, politicians are seeking ways to increase the rate of government spending. What of the funding of on-budget debt? This is now in the range of $12 trillion. Congress does not examine the sources of the funding. Members assume that the Treasury will be able to find buyers at 0% interest. Who exactly? Asian central banks, oil-exporting nations, which are all running massive government deficits. Foreign private investors, the Federal Reserve System. This thought is not, of course, publicly tolerated. The bankruptcy of the U.S. government, which actually could be through hyperinflation above 50% per annum, a collapse of the dollar. But it could also be done by selective defaults. But here I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it will be done. The Treasury will either renege on its debt or else the government will pass laws cutting expected benefits. Perhaps a combination of these will be the most politically acceptable approach. There is no way that the Treasury's debt can or will ever be repaid. If you haven't heard it before, you heard it here first. Everyone knows this, including Chinese central banks and politicians. You know, when Saturday Night Live opens with a skit on Obama's visit to China, where Obama keeps telling President Jinping that China will get its money back, and President Jinping asks him how exactly, and Obama cannot say, "We know that the world knows that America's debt is never going to be repaid." The live Saturday Night Live audience gets it. The audience at home gets it. Everyone gets it. China is not going to get its money back. You know, while the skit utilizes some crude humor, the message is clear. The economic data in the skit are factually accurate. When the details of America's foreign trade disaster could be turned into a Saturday Night Live skit, the word is out. Nothing changes. Nothing will change until China and other nations cease playing kick the can. Asian politicians have been committed ever since 1945 to a form of mercantilism. They have exported goods to the West, especially to the United States. They have built up foreign currency reserves, debts issued by the national governments of the importing nations. China holds over $2 trillion in total reserves, not all dollars. India holds about $300 billion. These two nations were third world basket cases as recently as 1990. Instead of building up gold reserves as mercantilist nations sought to do in Adam Smith's day, they have accumulated IOUs issued by mainly Western national governments. Asian central banks have inflated their domestic monetary bases in order to purchase foreign currency denominated debt. On the day that they cease buying American debt, other buyers must be found. Buyers who think that 0% per annum is a good rate of return for an asset. The dollar that is declining in purchasing power. Asian nations continue to give away their nation's goods in exchange for promises of repayment in foreign currencies that will decline in value. Are they really this stupid? No, they are merely ill-informed economically. They don't believe Smith's Wealth of Nations. They remain mercantilistic in their thinking. They think that promises to pay no interest long-term is worth buying. Why? Because they began subsidizing their export sectors as the pathway to wealth. They began inflating in order to keep down the price of their currencies in international markets. This made it cheaper for Western importers to buy their currencies and in turn buy exported goods. Once their domestic investors had invested capital in factories to produce goods for Western consumers, any reduction of the subsidies would threaten unemployment. They had been riding the digital tiger. This domestic monetary inflation has created capital market bubbles in their nations. The governments fear a collapse of their stock markets and real estate markets. They fear widespread unemployment even more. So what did they do? They have instructed their central banks to inflate. China has increased M2 by 30% a year over the last year. Before, the central bank had inflated at 16% or so. China is no longer buying treasury debt. It ceased in May 2009 when holdings peaked at $801.5 billion. This is now down to $799 billion. Then who is buying this debt? Well, I'm sure some of you know the answer to this one, don't you, ladies and gentlemen? The Federal Reserve. It reversed course in June. Since then, it accelerated the rate of expansion. Since August, the adjusted monetary base has risen at a 100% rate per annum. The U.S. Treasury has to roll over its debt every 50 months. This is down from 70 months in 2000. At $12 trillion, this is $3 trillion a year. And to this must be added an additional $1 trillion a year, and this will repeat every fiscal year. There should be no confusion about where this is heading, ladies and gentlemen. The government's share of the economy will increase if the commercial banks refuse to lend, based on the increase in the monetary base. When they do lend, this will be translated into an increase in M1. The money supply will rise unless the Fed increases banks' legal reserve requirements. At that point, the Fed must decide which tiger to ride, the inflationary tiger or the depressionary tiger. It can cease buying treasury debt or keep buying and watch the dollar sink by 20%, 30%, or more per year. In any case, Asia's mercantilism will at long last hit the wall. Their export industries will hit either the wall of a Great Depression too, which is few orders, or else mass inflation. Orders in money not worth holding. Asian mercantilism is going to fail sometime in the next 5 years. And from the looks of China's recent refusal to add to its holding of dollars, the central bank may have begun this transition. The government's adoption of a massive Keynesian stimulus package indicates that its economists have realized that mercantilism is for dummies. So is Keynesianism. China is playing kick the can. It's inflating faster than ever. It's riding the same inflationary tiger that the West is. It cannot get off without moving to the depressionary tiger. It wants to delay the decision until rising prices for commodities choke off the economy. Long-term thinking is not characteristic of politicians of any hue. Their time perspective is limited by the date of the next election. The owner of a piece of property benefits from any price appreciation of the market value of that asset. In contrast, a politician cannot legally capture the value of the price appreciation of assets owned by the government. He is tempted, he is sorely tempted to gain for his personal use the value of government assets. He accomplishes this by performing the equivalent of alchemy, the transmutation of government capital into votes. There is a popular myth that the government must preserve assets for future generations because private enterprise wastes resources in the present. This makes no economic sense. Private ownership furthers the conservation of assets that owners believe will appreciate. They want to capture the value of this increase in value. Politicians are more likely to consume government-owned resources in such a way that incumbents are re-elected. Civil service protected bureaucrats are anxious to gain more control over assets. The agencies may lease the assets to private industry, thereby capturing the value of the output for the agency or the department. The public is no different. It also wants to defer the day of judgment. It wants stable prices, which it now has. It wants low unemployment. It's getting the opposite. It wants low interest rates, which it now has. It wants economic growth. The government's Bureau of Economic Analysis dutifully now reports this. Meanwhile, tax receipts in the states continue to fall, indicating economic contraction. Americans refuse to look at their retirement portfolios and ask this question, will I be able to live comfortably on this capital? With interest rates at banks under 1%, the answer is an obvious no. Yet they do not change. They do not triple or quadruple their rate of savings. They do not plan to stay in the workforce until 75 or 80. They do not buy foreign currencies or gold. They do not plan to start a business to retire into. The voters want the government to guarantee them a safe retirement, Medicare benefits, a stable dollar. But the government is already so far down the road to default that it can only play kick the can. The depressionary tiger will maul us. We want to defer the decision. To perceive what is about to happen is not the same thing as taking evasive action. People want to believe that the numbers will not get worse for them. They may believe that things will get worse for strangers, but they do not believe that this could happen to them. Most people know nothing of all this. The audience that laughed at the Saturday Night Live skit did not wake up on Sunday morning and say, what the Treasury is going to do to China is what it's going to do to the rest of us. They assume this. The Chinese are fools to let us do this to them, but the government would never do this to us. The government has implicitly promised not to default on its sovereign debt. The trouble with sovereign debt is that it's issued by sovereign governments. Sovereign governments are sovereign. That is to say, they are above the law. They enforce the laws they choose to enforce. Short of going to war, foreign governments cannot compel compliance. The voters think they can enforce compliance, but they cannot get blood out of a turnip. They also cannot get money out of a bankrupt government. Some can, but not everyone. Everyone thinks, I am in the group of citizens who will get paid. Obviously, not everyone can be correct about this. The numbers tell us that there will be a default. But psychologically, even the tiny handful of people who understand the implication of the numbers do not all take evasive action. The cost of action is higher in the short run than the cost of inaction. It isn't in the long run, but the long run doesn't command respect in a present-oriented culture. This is why kick the can is such a popular pastime. People assume that the bad numbers will improve merely from the passage of time. They believe that sovereign governments are sovereign over economic cause and effect. They don't believe in rigorous cause and effect. They believe in it only insofar as it benefits them personally. They believe in selective causation, the acceptance of the idea that objectively bad numbers will not compound over time is an indication of a person's rejection of economic causation. It is an acceptance of the efficacy of perception without action. Count the personal costs of inaction. If the bad numbers are compounding faster than the good numbers, draw the correct conclusion. Inaction will turn out to be very expensive. Then take appropriate evasive action. Ladies and gentlemen, that is what we talk about constantly on the show here, taking evasive action. And I've told you in the past, the first thing you need to learn is that talking to people who are apparently in the know is the kiss of death. People are not talking to you in your best interests. They each have an agenda. Each person who speaks to you is either a politician, a member of the media, a member of the financial services organizations, and they all have their individual agendas to attend to. And they're all going to give you a hard time. Because if you listen to what they say, you will be supporting their interests, but you will be going down a path of self-destruction. And I assure you that it doesn't matter what program you watch on television, what newspaper you pick up, you're going to get the same bad advice. What is the advice you're getting today? Buy stocks, buy gold, buy bonds, buy commodities. This is a disaster. Ladies and gentlemen, it is all bad advice. How many people are telling you to take your money and put it in treasury bills and leave it alone and go to sleep for the next 2 or 3 years and wake up with more assets than 99% of your friends and family and associates? Nobody. Nobody is telling you this because nobody gains from this. Nobody is in the business of telling you what you need to know with no axe to grind. And that's where I hope I come in for you, ladies and gentlemen. That's what I try to do here. I have no axe to grind. I merely do this in order to give some form of information as a service to people who have no other means to obtain it. And that is the truth. I have no other ulterior motive in telling you these things. And it should be obvious to you that I gain nothing from doing this. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But it's not for want of trying. I do read avidly several hours a day. I cull information, some of it good, some of it bad. More good than bad, I must tell you, because I have access to very interesting and effective avenues of information. But nevertheless, the time will come when things will get better. But it's a long time in the future. And if you think there's no precedent, just go and look at Japan. 20 years of a downturn and still counting. And I'm afraid that we're looking at very much the same thing here. And the more the government does, the longer it's going to take to right the ship. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it will be Friday when you listen to this show. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. I'll be back with you on Sunday night at 9 p.m. for the discussion group and on Monday at the usual time for another edition of The Wake Up Call. Bye-bye till then.